of the Music Director at P.O. Box 3157, Eugene, Oregon 97403. All genres are accepted. Make sure you include contact information. Once again, send your submissions to KWVA Radio, care of the Music Director, at P.O. Box 3157, Eugene, Oregon 97403. Send KWVA Eugene your music, and you may just hear it on the air. KWVA Eugene plays local music.
The views expressed on this program are not necessarily the views of KWVA Radio or the Associated Students of the University of Oregon. Anarchy Radio is an editorial collage providing analysis and opinions of John Zerzan and the community at large. September 4th. Summer is still going strong. Huh? It's 80s. Just outstanding. Just lovely. Well, we got some news. We got some readings. Just going to see how it plays out tonight. I might read part of The Sea, the last thing I wrote, or half of it, or none of it. First of all, let's just do some news and see what else we get to. And we're going to have a reading at the end of the show. I know that. That'll be good. So, okay. Several things happened last Thursday, thanks to the Obama government. On Thursday, for starters, the Justice Department announced that there would be no criminal charges about CIA torture. And, of course, that goes along with quite a few other little breaches. Goes along with pro-fracking. Goes along with lots of things. Also Thursday, the decision to allow preparatory drilling by Shell up in the Arctic, the Chukchi Sea, oh so controversial, but this is hardly a surprise. And also on Thursday, this didn't come to light until Saturday, the U.S. government has decided to stop training those Afghan forces because they tend to turn their guns on American troops. Yeah, the intense surge of insider killings by Afghan forces against their Western trainers. Just a little hard to take. Meanwhile, there is something called Drones Plus. You might have heard about this. This is an app for iPhones cooked up by one Josh Begley, grad student guy. This shows you where all the drone strikes have happened. And Apple pulled the plug on this. They've rejected this software. Inappropriate. And it's not, and it falls under the wording, as I understand it, of what generally is cut off because it's too graphic or it could be top secret. This is none of those things. It's just dots on a map. And this isn't exactly secret information. It doesn't, it's just Apple being part of the government, I guess. Well, sir, there was a convention last week, and there's another convention that started today. I thought one of the interesting things about the Repubs was how few people were watching. 23-point plunge in ratings. That was at their wind-up thing. And it turns out that of the people that were watching on the big screen, the great majority were 55 or older. So that's a good, but all the articles, all the media about this points out that, well, there was a lot of social media happening. There's all kinds of streaming and tweeting, but actually there's been a decline in viewership for political conventions for a good 20 years. So that's only part of it. And I don't know, there's any number of things one could point out. For one thing, how tightly scripted and controlled these things are. Nobody thinks they're really seeing anything. And, well, that's probably not totally new, is it? But it's just more phony. And the one that started tonight at the Time Warner Cable Convention Center, the Barack Obama speech on Thursday, I'm pretty sure it's Thursday, will be at the Bank of America Stadium. So that's kind of all you need to know, it strikes me, about that. Let's not waste any more time. And speaking of social media, more sinking of the Facebook flagship. I hate Facebook. The stock continues to go down. All these articles, Facebook shares hit new lows, blurry future for Facebook. And this Bizarro, this is Saturday, the comic strip Bizarro. The dad pokes his head into the daughter's room and says, "I'm worried about you, sweetie. You're too old to have imaginary friends." And she says, "It's called Facebook, Dad." But no, they're imaginary, aren't they? Well, Friday the 31st, there was a blue moon. And you know what accompanies this. We have this web-based SLU space camera, which showcases those live views. And, of course, the point is, why go outside when you can get the great real-time observation on the screen? It's always much better. And the drought news, crops in India wilt in a weak monsoon season, and just more and more and more predictions, more reports on the intensification, the predictions in the coming decades, more drying out because of climate change and how crops are devastated all around the world this year, according to the World Meteorological Organization and many other groups. Oh, I overlooked one thing. Speaking of the conventions, yeah, I want to stick this in. There was an interview with Noam Chomsky in the September issue of Z magazine. This is absolutely no surprise. It's roughly about politics and administration, political administration in a general sense, and in a more specific sense. And it winds up with the question, what are your recommendations to voters in this election? Vote. And Chomsky, the vaunted, noted, flag-bearing anarchist that he is, "Voters can have most impact on election day or any day by dedicating themselves to efforts that will mobilize popular forces to achieve important ends." Does that make any sense? By voting, you mobilize popular forces? No, it doesn't. But here's the punchline. "As for voting, my feeling is that the Republican organization today is extremely dangerous. not just to this country but to the world, it's worth expending some effort to prevent their rise to power without sowing illusions about the Democratic alternatives. So you're urged to vote for the Democrat, but without sowing illusions about the Democrats. That's another good trick. What a joke, this guy. This is just straight up liberal nonsense. Just keep salivating over it. Just keep playing the game. And you could be an anarchist like Noam Chomsky. Well, the shooting of the week, early Friday. Ex-Marine opened fire in camouflage gear at a supermarket, gunning down two co-workers, ex-co-workers, before he killed himself. That'll have to do. We don't want to go way off into shootings like we usually do. Well, we've got just to mention a few things apropos the general state of the biosphere. This is a three-page story, front-page story in the New York Times today, having to do with the fact that Africa is in the midst of an epic elephant slaughter. Yeah. And this is something that came to light. It's actually happened in July, but a massacre of Yanomami Indians deep in the Amazon jungle by Brazilian gold miners. Another clash with indigenous groups. Mining along with dams. It's just been a fantastic onslaught against indigenous cultures, indigenous lifeways on every continent. And I mentioned this last week. I cited last week the record melting of Arctic ice, and then the further fact that this losing Arctic sea ice accelerates global warming. It isn't just that is accelerating, but that in itself is accelerating global warming. And ABC News on Sunday, September 2nd, had a pretty fair article called Michigan and Bangalore, Global Warming Goes Global. And talking about the records all over the world, driest on record, continents beginning to dry out, and the giant icebergs breaking off and the whole nine yards. And here is what sounds like a very good new book, The Great Animal Orchestra by Bernie Krause. This is reported on. It's brand new. The Guardian out of England wrote about it. Bernie Krause is a musician and naturalist, and he's talking about the sounds from what is left of nature, what is left of wild nature. He spent 40 years now recording over 15,000 species, some of which are gone now. He's talking about the rate of species extinction with specific focus on habitats that no longer exist because they've been so compromised by human noise. That's, the vast orchestra of life, the chorus of the natural world, is in the process of being quietened. There's been a massive decrease in the density and diversity of key vocal creatures, both large and small. And I want to say, speaking of books, this has just been verified as much as it can be. Enrico Manicardi's book, Freed from Civilization, will be out in January. That's the focus. That's the due date, as we understand it, the target date from Little Black Cart, and that's going pretty darn well. That's a major project. It is the big fat A to Z anti-civilization book. Just a word on books. And just as randomly here, AP story from Friday the 31st in Idaho, eastern Idaho rivers and streams. State fisheries biologists are reporting an increase in the number of mountain whitefish dying. The die-off is troubling. They don't know why. One more of those things. But some good news here. Manufacturing is down in Asia and in Europe. So maybe we're getting a little break here. Slowdown in orders hits factories in China, all over the place. Eurozone contraction, etc. And here's an article. This is probably not the last word on this, but Today in the New York Times, big story by Kenneth Chang. Stanford scientists cast doubt on advantages of organic meat and produce. The upshot of this, it's an analysis of 237 studies. It's kind of like this mega study. And the bottom line is that organic fruits and vegetables are on average no more nutritious than their conventional counterparts, which tend to be far less expensive. Now, nor are they any less likely to be contaminated by dangerous bacteria like E. coli. Now, this is a little bit shocking. I think the deep reality, not to go into detail with this, but I think with the deep reality is that you have massified monoculture domestication, the industrial scale, the globalized nature, whether it's organic or not, even though I do find it surprising that there would be no advantage to eating food that isn't sprayed. It's, this is the bottom line on this. I know that, since I'm an alum, by the way, Stanford is known for having a right-wing slant on a lot of folks there. It's kind of well known. It's the only sort of top-ranked school that does have that slant. So I don't know if there are no effects from pesticides, and if large-scale conventional farming is the same as large-scale organic farming, and that's what we're talking about here. We're not talking about some tiny patch somewhere, I guess. This is the public, the general, when we talk about organic, what's labeled organic and is available at large. So again, we'll probably hear more about that. And one more thing. This is from today's Wall Street Journal. How to live high on the hog during a drought. You could guess that, Wall Street Journal, the pigs that they are. this is part of their piece here. In economic terms, livestock are farmyard refineries converting grain into protein. That's a lovely way to put it, huh? Yeah, you know. And this is how you can, manipulate hog futures and so forth and just come out just fine, even though a lot of people are hurting. Just dandy. Well, before the break, and this is just meant to be a little bit of an intro thing. I'm really hoping to encourage discussion and kind of open this up. By the way, 541-346-0645. Do call us. We're going to have some kind of a post-Mebo thing.
Yeah. We got the secret word, the advance notice. There will be a new chat system at the website in just a couple of weeks.
That'll be great.
3 weeks, maybe?
Good. Yeah, that'll be good to give. Have that.
We'll say a month to give us time to get used to it and figure out how it works.
Yeah, ironed out the bugs. Okay. I'm glad to hear that. Yeah, we just got the word just minutes ago. Well, I wanted to just kick off a few comments, and not quite chosen at random, but I want to say that I don't want this to be taken as some big overview that I'm absolutely wedded to. I'm talking about a new book, a small book called The Collected Communiques of Individualists Tending Toward the Wild. And this is published by War on Society with an introduction by someone called Plain Words. In Spanish, this is from Mexico, individualidades tendiendo a lo salvaje. Let's just call it ITS for short. And again, that's individualists tending toward the wild, or it could be translated as individuals tending toward the wild. I tend to think that's a little less confusing because individualist has a number of historical, political connotations, at least, may or may not apply. So what we have here is about 100 pages, 110 pages, and these people truly are the heirs of Ted Kaczynski. They have sent bombs to various high-tech people with a special focus, it seems like, on nanotech people. They killed a nanotech, kind of a chief engineer, about a year ago. So this is pretty heavy stuff, and this is rare material. This stuff, I think it really should be debated. And I do think back to the Unabomber days when that was, especially in 1995, just before Ted Kaczynski was captured, there was quite a widespread public discussion, fairly widespread, not enormous, but and I'm hoping that this might kick that off again. And I don't suppose that, as the earlier case, there's any real way to separate the ideas from the violence. That's a whole question in itself. But I think that these folks clearly are vehemently anti-technology. And I just want to mention just a couple of things here, maybe for further discussion. I'm going to read something from the very first communique, which was only last April 2011. And they're talking about some of their actions and what they have in mind. With this action we conducted, we have not struck powerfully at the Mega Machine, and we are aware that with us we have not changed anything. Maybe the state or federal police now protect the university community. Maybe nanotechnologists will realize that we see them as enemies. Perhaps the state of Mexico will begin more in-depth investigations, but nothing more. And we say this because we know that all the efforts we make against the techno-industrial system are useless. We have seen the immensity of this great mass of metal and concrete, and we realize that all we ever do at one time or another will not stop progress, and less so if there are still false radicals and leftist struggles that aim at the destruction of a target, but have not yet noticed nor have not viewed beyond that all this does not do anything. Some may think that this is pessimistic, that we have fallen into defeatism, but no, if we had fallen into these traps of civilization, would not be making explosives for technology staff. We say this rather because it is the reality, and we know that reality hurts. What is needed is to hit hard from within a Unabomberist idea at the system. That's a question. To put nanobiotechnology, telecommunication industry, electricity, computers, oil in our sights? And if we strike them unanimously with others in different countries, all that, what would happen? Would we deter anything? Civilization is collapsing and a new world will be born through the efforts of anti-civilization warriors? Please, let us see the truth, plant our feet on the ground, and let leftism and illusions fly from our minds. The revolution has never existed, nor have revolutionaries. Those who view themselves as potential revolutionaries and seek a radical anti-technology shift are truly being idealistic and irrational, because none of that exists. In this dying world, only individual autonomy, capitalized, exists, and it is for this that we fight. And although all this is useless and futile, we prefer to be defeated in a war against total domination than to remain inert, passive, waiting, or as part of all this. We prefer to position ourselves on the side of wild fauna and flora that remain. We prefer to return to nature, respect her absolutely, and abandon the cities to maintain our claim as anti-civilization warriors. We prefer to continue the war that we have declared years ago, knowing that we will lose, but promising ourselves that we will give our greatest effort. Okay, now that is a mouthful, and I just seem to see that there's really a lot of despair around, and that could hardly be a great shock, but to absolutely rule out any change, it really strikes me as then you have this sort of private existentialist sort of thing, which I applaud, by the way. I have for years. Well, we need to sort that out a little bit as well. But, you know, knowing that we will lose, I mean, you don't know that. But you're making it so by declaring that. You are contributing to that. And, you know, by the way, I was talking to a friend of mine about this the other evening, and she said that part of the problem may be in terms of even criticizing these texts and this whole approach, that winning or losing is somehow a false choice or a false formulation to even talk about winning or losing. But I'm confused by that as well, I have to admit, because I know what I mean by winning or losing. losing is the continued existence of this suicidal, this whole ruinous dominant order, and which gets more negative and unhealthy and crazy all the time. And winning would obviously be putting an end to it. And I haven't given up on seeing an end to it. I think it's not as all-powerful as some of these people seem to think, and that you throw in the towel before you've even started. Maybe I need to, I'd like to hear more from other people about this, and maybe for one thing, simply to grok, if it's absolutely hopeless, then you're killing people and risking your freedom in your life for what? I don't really quite get that. And also I would say that there's something really ultra-rationalist about this that I'm just put off a little bit by. Again, though, for a long time now, I've been pretty vehemently anti-tech myself. And when a lot of people ran for cover during the Unabomber days before he was captured, did not want to discuss the ideas, did not even want to discuss the ideas out of fear, there were not so many people who did. So I think there's kind of this implication that you are somehow leftist or civilized if you don't accept that we're simply screwed, full stop, period. You know, I don't accept that, and I'm not a leftist. Anyway, there's something, they even capitalize the word reason at times, which, I don't know, you don't have to be an irrationalist to kind of wonder about that. It's very anti-spiritual. It's rather, I don't know, it's rather cold, rather masculinist, and I don't know why that's necessary. I don't know how that fits in with the rest of it. And maybe other people read this differently. I hope they do, actually, because I'm not bringing this up to trash it, but I'm just a little mystified. I think their critique all the way through is on target, if you pardon the pun. I really do. I think their focus on nanotechnology, just for a detail, is part of edge stuff. You attack at the strongest point. The more insidious and deeply colonizing point, I think that's just fine. And I kind of wonder, maybe other, again, can people can come in, and they do proclaim their solidarity with other people, other imprisoned fighters who are anarchists and perhaps still all too leftist. And I would even say that, not that I think everybody's a leftist, I really don't. But anyway, this whole thing is just fascinating. And I do think that, among other things, this could be somewhat momentous. Even I don't know if it was a coincidence that when the Unabomber ideas became prominent behind the fact that he killed three people, let's face it, and injured quite a number of others, it didn't take too much time after that there were a lot of folks, especially a lot of young folks, that started realizing that you could do something. And not that they were sending bombs to people. I'm not in favor of mailing bombs to people, but I'm not so sure that there wasn't some connection between these ideas bursting out in the open and a certain upsurge that happened within a couple of years or so. I certainly saw that here in Eugene, quite frankly. I saw kids who totally got what Kaczynski was writing about in Industrial Society and its Future. They totally grasped that. And at that point, I thought something really interesting could be starting, or not. I mean, because there were some signs already. And what we generally refer to now as anti-globalization, it didn't last that long. That was just a few years, but it was significant, and that it started a deepening in terms of the critique and the vision, it seems to me. I just hope we're not at the place now where people more often than not might go on fighting with no hope whatsoever. I don't think that's necessary. So please, if I may bring this up next week, or you might bring this up next week, or you might call us tonight and kind of weigh in. If you're familiar with this phenomenon, whether you're familiar with this little book, which is quite new, or not. All right, I think we're going to take a break. Be back at you soon.
My darling young one, I stumbled on the sides of 12 misty mountains. I walked and I crawled on 6 crooked highways. I've stepped in the middle of 7 sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans, and it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart. Rains are gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. I saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart. And it's a hard rain, it's gonna fall. Oh, what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? Are the sounds of a thunder that roared out a warning? I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were ablazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. Songs of a poet who died in the gutter. I heard the sounds of a clown who cried in the alley. And it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart, and it's a heart. Rains are gonna fall. Oh, who did you meet, my blue-eyed son? And who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman whose body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man who was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. And it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard, and it's a hard road. It's gonna fall. Oh, what'll you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what'll you do now, my darling young one? I'm going back out for the rain starts a-falling. I'll head for the depths of the deepest...
Ecken, somebody's on the line. Yes. Keith?
Yeah, am I on?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. I'd like to ask what your opinion is on the role of psychiatry in civilization, and if it does anything to sort of perpetuate this world system that we're living under. Because I've sort of noticed that it almost functions as like a sort of hidden like thought police or emotion police, where people like feel things that fall outside the reservation, so to speak. They're like, you know, they're persecuted in a sense, or if they think in certain ways that are considered abnormal, then they're persecuted. Like a lot of the people who might be classified as schizophrenic by like a psychiatrist would probably have been considered like a shaman or something like that by some of these indigenous tribes. So I'm just curious what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, that's a big question. Of course, there is a huge amount of psychic pain. There's so much anxiety, there's rising autism, and there's depression, and there's just so many... People are enduring so much, it's hardly surprising that people turn to heavy drugs, even with all the side effects. That's really what psychiatry or that field in general is now, is just dispensing all these more or less addictive drugs to people, tens of millions. And we see that just invading a lot of different spheres, where people can't sleep without drugs, males can't have sex without drugs. It, again, the addictive aspect of all this, it's just people are trying to cope. I mean, I know a lot, I bet everybody knows somebody who is debilitated by depression or whatever it is, you know, mostly depression. That's probably one of the big standout things. So, I mean, I'm not going to sit here and say, well, you shouldn't have anything for that. But, of course, that's not the solution. It's what kind of society is it that engenders so much dis-ease, so much ill health and stress and the whole thing? You know, it's the picture is, it's not going to be solved by psychiatry or all the different shrinks. I mean, I'm not saying they don't do any good, but... As I think you know, this is just it just opens out onto the whole question of how society gets this way and how it could be some other way.
Yeah, that's sort of my feelings on it as well. Like, I just know that like one of my friends, he ended up going to like a psychiatrist, and ever since he's been on this medication that they're giving him for so-called bipolar disorder, he just hasn't been like the same person. Like, he used to make jokes a lot and stuff, and now his emotions have just sort of like flatlined. And I mean, I'm not like entirely sure what he was going through, but I liked him better. But before he sort of resorted to this, to what he had to resort to, and I just wish.
Yeah, that's why people drop the drugs. You know, they don't keep taking their meds because they have this flattened affect. They become reduced to in a way to cope with the extremes of their condition, you know. So it's no surprise why people just end up going off their meds. You know, so Well, thanks a lot, man. Thanks a lot. And yeah, if you've got any more on the subject, you can share it with us.
Not really at the moment. I mean, like, the subject has really just come to, like, the forefront of the stuff that I'm looking at due to this experience that I've been having with this close friend of mine, and it's just been sort of disturbing. And I've read some of your stuff before, and it got me thinking, like, well, what's the role of civilization in this sort of situation where some people feel they have to resort to this, or how was this even developed to begin with? I mean, you know, these are questions that I've really been grappling with recently.
Yeah, yeah. Heavy waters. Well, good luck. Good luck. We're all trying to figure these things out and be of help to people that are in pain and or whatever their variety of pain is. We're all under the gun, you know, and but some of us are luckier than others, I think. Take care.
All right. Thanks. Yeah.
I think for right now I'm going to read maybe half of my most recent thing. I mentioned it before the sea. Maybe get to the other half next week. I don't think we'll have more time than that. Simply called The Sea, Last Remaining Lair of Unparalleled Wildness, Too Big to Fail. The whole world is being objectified, but Melville reminds us of all that remains. There you stand, lost in the infinite series of the sea. What could be more tangible, more of a contrast with being lost in the digital world, where we feel we can never properly come to grips with anything? Oceans are about time more than space, quote, as if there were a correlation between going deep and going back. The deep is solemn, linking in some way all that has come before, last things and first things. Heaven, in quotes, by comparison, is thin and faintly unserious. All over the face of Earth main ocean flowed, announced the poem by John Milton. Given its 71% predominance on this planet, why is our world called Earth instead of sea? Much of the land, in fact, could be defined as literal areas where land and sea meet. The sea is a textured place, infinite in its moods, forms, energies, and not so easily detextured. But we see what happens when culture is privileged over place. The sea, where all life began just this side of 4 billion years ago, must still sustain us. Not only are its waters the original source of life, it also shapes the climate, weather, and temperature of the planet, and therefore the status of terrestrial species. Kant saw truth as akin to an island surrounded by a stormy sea. Water might run wildly and drown reason. Chaos, disorder were always to be feared and brought under control. In Milton's Paradise, the sea is chafing under restraint, suggesting that it can yield truth when freed. The power of nature is to be respected, not domesticated. We come to life in water in the amniotic fluid. Blood and tears are salty like the sea. Menstrual cycles like the tides in the maternal sea are mother. The sea is mountains rolling, sometimes calm and tempered. For Swinburne, quote, the storm sounds only more notes of more delight. So many qualities, even phosphorescent at times, as I have seen on the Sea of Cortez. The seascape shows a magnificent array of fluctuating aspects and energies. John Ruskin found therein, to all human minds, the best emblem of unwearied, unconquerable power, the wild, various, fantastic, tameless unity of the sea. If the earth is alive, the oceans are its most living parts. The sea whispers, croons, bellows in its unnumbered moods. Always the ground note of the planet's undersong, as George Sterling put it. The very pulse of the sea, not only its perpetual motion, has us imagining that it is drawing breath. Inspirations and exhalations of a living, if unimaginably vast, animal. Many have written of the sea as a fellow creature. Malcolm Lowry recorded this meditation. Each drop into the sea is like a life, I thought, each producing a circle in the ocean, or the medium of life itself, and widening into infinity. In the deep, there is beauty and music. The sweeping surge of it is a matchless strength, a tireless spirit of freedom. Writing in his journal in 1952, Thomas Merton noted, that every wave of the sea is free. We might seek a heart like the sea, ever open and at liberty. Lorne Eisley decided that if there is magic on this planet, it is contained in water. Why does running water, even a fountain or an aquarium, soothe or even heal? Far, far more potent, incomparable, is the spell of the ocean. I was born in the breezes, and I have studied the sea as perhaps few men have studied it, neglecting all else, Joshua Slocum revealed in his late 19th century account, Sailing Alone Around the World. For many, the sea demands a deep loyalty, prompted by sheer wonder and the promise of peak experiences, a sense of being fully animal and fully alive, ocean-hearted. The sea's staggering presence, its pure openness, brings on very powerful sensations. Rimbaud perhaps went furthest in trying to capture it in words. I have recovered it. What? Eternity. It is the sea matched with the sun. As the young Joyce evoked the sea, the clouds were drifting above him silently, and silently the sea tangle was drifting below him, and the gray warm air was still, and a wild new life was singing in his veins. On and on and on he strode, far, far out over the sands, singing wildly to the sea, crying to greet the advent of the life that had cried to him. The sea, our deepest origin, calls to us. Seaborne, we are drawn seaward. Alan Corbin, discussing the work of Adolphe de Custine, recounts the latter's orientation toward that which, quote, instinctively relates to our origins. Namely, that the sight of the open sea contributes to the discovery of the deep inner self. There is an exalting and revelatory experience possible in such a confrontation with the elements. We are humbled at the shore, on the waves, our presence a question. The completeness and certainty of nature makes life bearable, less anguished, as Richard Nelson has written. When I was a small child at mid-century, our family sometimes drove west about 60 miles to visit my dad's brother, Ed, on the central Oregon coast. My brother and I competed to be the first to see the ocean and cry, I see it! It was a thrill to catch that first glimpse every time. About 30 years later, I came back to Oregon from California and worked in Newport at a shrimp cannery near places called Boiler Bay and Devil's Punch Bowl. I don't think it's surprising that one can feel giddy at the massive sight. The Pacific encompasses fully one-third of the globe, 64 million square miles, twice the size of the Atlantic, the absolute anti-monumental there of it. Is it not true that we're all somehow called to the sea by its lure, persuasion, gravity? Until he was 40, John Ruskin was drawn to have, quote, merely stared all day at the tumbling and creaming strength of the sea. A century later, Robert Frost wrote, the people along the sand all turn and look one way. They turn their back on the land. They look at the sea all day, where every wave is different and the heart and soul expand. Lorne Eisley felt the Gulf of Mexico pulling him southward as he lazed in the Platte River, and more than that, quote, I was water. In 1826, Heinrich Heine expressed a similar union. I love the sea as my soul. Often it seems to me that the sea really is my soul. Swimming in the ocean involves an intimate immensity, to borrow a term from Gaston Bachelard. It connects with vastness and is inward, yet also a vigorous and robust experience. There can be challenges and perils, of course. Robert Louis Stevenson described a Hawaiian woman who swam for 9 hours in a high sea, carrying the body of her husband home. Albert Camus confided, I have always felt I lived on the high seas, threatened at the heart of a royal happiness. Okay, I think I'll read the get to the next half of it next week. 2 weeks. Catherine will be here. Well, we're going to close with a reading, and we may have just a little bit of time left, but that's okay. Yeah. Okay. Here, let's switch chairs. I think you got a faulty chair there. Why don't you just sit here? And according to Carl, it's better to have two mics working.
Hi. That which begets, that which destroys, that which begets the intent to destroy, that which intends to beget to destroy. Did peace ever come? Take our country back, some say, from this absent presence, from the future's lie. Every creature under clock face, every stick man has its smoky sun. Where is the back to take it to in multitasking quantum time? Where's front? Where's back? Our country take, our country took your dreams and sold you back. To country back, to Indian. Indian country, country Indian. Who's Indian in country? Who's country in Indian? No Indian in country, no country in Indian. In Indian, no country in country, no Indian. Take it back through all ghost ancestors. Dig up the graves, put dust in the museums. Take us all the way back into and before every false nation stole. Torch for the harbor, no welcoming, no myth-making for occupiers, for conquerors. My father had some little books I heard but did not read the words of war. My father was a soldier who came back to tell us stories, how to disbelieve in heroes, buy and sell our evil, buy and sell our good. They kill you, you kill them. Good men, bad men, kill you, you kill them. For the two cities, hard rain, burning rivers, wrong voyage. Gunter Anders was sentenced to obscure old age in federal mental hospital because he wrote a little book, had flown a plane, had dropped a bomb, had banked the giant plane away, but felt the heat, but saw the light that burns all blind men's eyes who look toward a no man's sun. A cloud rose 10 miles high. A cloud became a symbol. These are wars forever not to win. Whole truth will not be told, and now this story's old. Bleach white the bone of conscience, whose? Not ours, not theirs. Burn shadows into stone. You don't believe? It's one man's nightmare. Hero's perfect memory, his guilt. Let's call it moral genius, lost to all but one. Shut up, go back to work, be bored to die of disbelief, then make your reparations in the hills. Good men, bad men, kill you, you kill them. They kill you, you kill them. I sat in the last seat of the back row, barricaded my desk with piles of books I did not read and could not hear, and slept through every jailhouse class in high school, boot camp, San Diego, turned to listen for the little birds who played and sang and flew between the pepper trees, Brazilian, in their timeless everyday, no work, all play in 1955. I felt the roar of Navy jets outside and overhead our endless drone of inside propaganda, high school education, not, no wise men for a fool like me. Imagined I was one to hide and run like rabbit from the bad boys' BB guns and curses. I imagined I was one among coyotes over Mesa, down the canyons, up the boulder-covered hillsides, lemonberry homelands. I imagined I was one to hide and run, get sick, go home from jailhouse school, leave bullies in their hallways, chant, intimidate their victims, beat the bad boys' drums. I dreamed that I was one to hide and run from every five-day morning, puffy-eyed through workaholic years. Too shy to say hello, I dreamed the pretty girls. The worst was yet to come under a smoky sun. I heard a thundering sky of Navy jets over our endless drone of inside propaganda. I imagined I was one to hide and run. After the fallout drifted south, conquerors conquered and conquer.
There's a lady who's sure all it glitters is gold, and she's buying the stairway to heaven. When she gets there, she knows if the stores are all closed, with a word she can get what she came for.